Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 36 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the all-ages writer Eleanor Updale wittily exposes one of the more absurd tics of modern broadcasting, and the novelist Jonathan Tulloch celebrates his childhood dialect with a dash of dramatic panache. First up, here's Eleanor with That Was Now, This Is Then, an attack on now-speak.
I'm calling for an uprising by the general public to stop a ridiculous assault on our language. The damage is being done by historians, and they're using radio and television to do it. We've got to stop the current fashion for using the present tense when describing the past. It's not just ugly, it can be confusing, and it is really no different from the descent into jargon that other professionals indulge in to differentiate themselves from ordinary humans. Other specialists may get away with their excluding and self-aggrandizing behaviour because they have unfamiliar codes to hand. Unfortunately for the historians, the language of their trade is the same as that available to the non-specialist, and the attempt to use it in a quirky way only highlights the absurdity of what is going on. Many modern historians are working with one of their main tools malfunctioning, and some of them probably feel they have to choose that faulty tool, simply because everyone else does. My argument against these people and their private language, which I shall call now-speak, rests on two main grounds. Avoiding the past tense makes it more difficult for historians to write engagingly, and very few of the now-speakers manage to use the historic present consistently as they speak and write. I also want to explore how and when this new fashion came about, and what we might do to eradicate it. I could find examples of now-speak in any lecture theatre at any university, but its most public use takes place on radio and television. Two of the main culprits are the celebrated Radio 4 programmes, In Our Time and The Long View. I'll use an extensive extract from In Our Time to illustrate both what I'm talking about and how difficult even professional practitioners of now-speak find their new language. I chose a programme at random from In Our Time's extensive archive. I'm certain I could have found a more extreme example. This is from the programme on the Battle of Agincourt. The participants are the programme's presenter, Melvin Bragg, Michael Jones, described as a medieval historian and writer, and Anne Curry, Professor of Medieval History at Southampton University. Of course, this was a live broadcast, and in any spontaneous exchange, grammar is bound to slip around, but the addition of now-speak into the mix introduces an extra and totally unnecessary irritation for the listener. The extract begins with Melvin Bragg. He's talking about the year 1415, which I think we can all agree is in the past. The English are actually following the French army across country, trying to delay them all the way, and the French presumably are looking for a place to settle and to choose the ground, which, as I understand, is one of the great things in medieval battle, if you get to choose the ground. Now Bragg is suddenly in the past. And they did. Now, can you talk about the ground they chose? Anne Curry starts in the present tense, but soon wobbles. I think it's important that it's near Calais. I think what they were after was cutting him off near Calais and then going off to take Calais later on. Also, he's getting weaker and weaker, shorter of food, and presumably his army was pretty depressed on the night of October the 24th, the night before, when they saw how many French were there. Melvin Bragg picks up the past tense from her. Why did the French choose that ground? Michael Jones fumbles the baton. Once Henry is able to cross this great river barrier of the Somme, and we must remember that the French had forced him further and further inland by holding the bridging points, so, as Anne has said, the army has got more and more tired and demoralised, they then have the option of blocking his army on the Calais road, on his route back, at a place of their choosing, and we know they had an initial battle plan. Bragg interjects. He's in the past again. The English were holding Calais at the time. It was a fortified place of refuge. This time, Jones follows suit, but not for long. That's right, that was where Henry was aiming for. That was where he was trying to get back to, so the French needed to block him on that route. And the choice is really whether they go for an all-out aggressive strategy. That was their plan A. Now, plan A really needed open countryside, and of course the final battlefield really wasn't open. But I think the reason for that is there's been a change of plan within the French army. They've moved from an aggressive plan A to an equally astute plan B, which is to block the route with these woods on either side and wait for the English to attack them. Anne Curry swoops, but she's in the past tense now. Of course, one of the reasons may be that the English captured the battle plan. That was only a short extract from a 45-minute programme. My point is that it's utterly unremarkable in its linguistic imprecision. It was a typical modern discussion between historians. No doubt they are masters in their fields, but I can't help thinking that their awkwardness of the English language undermines their authority in the mind of the listener. Obviously, it would be very easy to translate the whole exchange into the same tense, present or past, without losing anything. Equally obviously, I would prefer them to use the past tense throughout, but if you must use now speak, at least be consistent. Before asking why historians are behaving in this way, I'll take a look at the other Radio 4 culprit, The Long View. This is an otherwise excellent programme, based on a simple but inspired idea. Each episode focuses on an issue in the news at the moment and compares it with a similar event that happened in the past. It's hard to think of a format that lends itself more comfortably to the natural use of the English language. It should be obvious, and for once it might be possible to construct a positive case for NowSpeak as a helpful production advice. If you're going to use the present tense in descriptions, use it for current events, and use the past tense when referring to historic matters. Surely that would provide easy signposts for the listener. That was then, this is now. Alas, the house style is different. The present tense is used almost throughout, both by the presenter and by professional historians called in to help tell the story. The muddle is compounded by the use of accounts from past and present witnesses of events. These, of course, use the time-honoured language of reportage, which is almost invariably the past tense. So in a programme comparing the horrors of the 1860s workhouse with the 21st century scandal at the Mid-Staffordshire Hospital, we get, it's very minimally staffed. The only real medical professional that you have is a doctor. That was a historian describing the Victorian era. And there was barely any nurses. Those that were very uncaring. There was barely any leadership. Those that were there seemed to be the bullies. The conditions themselves were very unclean. Dressings on the floor, blood-spattered dressings. That was a witness referring to the present day. Once again, this is just a random example. Every edition of the programme suffers from a refusal to talk about the past as if it were the past. Now, you may be saying to yourself that it doesn't matter, that in context we understand which is the past and which is the present, that everyone knows that Henry V is dead and can do a simultaneous translation in their head if they hear that he is riding across the fields of northern France. But is that always true? I remember another edition of In Our Time, now sadly unavailable on the internet, which was about the Japanese samurai. It was profoundly unfamiliar territory for me, and I suspect for many other listeners. It covered several centuries of Japanese history about which I knew nothing. And yet at least one of the commentators persistently spoke in the present tense, coming out with statements along the lines of, Japanese society is profoundly spiritual. When? In the 10th century or now? Why should I know? How can I tell from what the man is saying? If he only said was instead of is, I would know straight away. And especially in a radio broadcast, which will probably be listened to by people subject to all sorts of distractions, why not be precise? The truth is that in this context, the use of NowSpeak is in fact designed to exclude the uninitiated. To put that point more kindly, it's there to embrace the knowledgeable into the thought processes of the expert. The commentator is implicitly saying, you know what I mean. So NowSpeak can be a barrier between historians and their audience, though I have no doubt that if called upon to defend its use, some would say that they tell tales in the present tense to make their accounts of the past more immediate are more relevant to a lay audience. Not only is that horribly patronising, but it ignores the fact that the natural tense for storytelling is the past tense. Would we feel more engaged with nursery rhymes if they ran, "Humpty Dumpty sits on a wall, Humpty Dumpty has a great fall, Jack and Jill go up the hill, who is killing Cock Robin?" The tense is immaterial. The tension comes from the image. That's not to say that the present tense can never work in literature, even in historical literature. Clearly, it didn't stand in the way of the success of Hilary Mantel's books on Thomas Cromwell, though I found it added nothing to my appreciation of the story. And even I have written a book entirely in the present tense. But fiction is different from history, which has a perfectly satisfactory grammar fit for all aspects of historical thought. So how, when, and why did the shift to now speak come about? I had a 30-year gap between my undergraduate study of history in the 1970s and my return to do a PhD. I know that the change happened during that time. Indeed, when I went back, the strange linguistic shift was one of the first things I noticed. My own theory is that it came about for two reasons, both of them connected with a crisis of confidence among academic historians around the turn of the century. Within the academic world, the humanities, and history in particular, began to lose the crown. On a popular level, some of the mystery was disappearing. Source material that could previously be accessed only in person and with a letter of introduction from an eminent professor was suddenly available to everyone online. Research grants were cut or reallocated to more practical subjects. In 2003, even the Education Secretary, Charles Clark, described most medieval historians as ornamental and not worthy of state grants. Though all the humanities were to suffer in the long term, at the end of the century, one discipline was thriving. The study of English literature was temporally, thanks to a foray into commentary on itself, the academic epicentre of cool. This was the era of the first interdisciplinary departments, where the skills of English and history were pooled, often to dramatic effect in understanding the past. But the literature scholars had their own language. And guess what? It made liberal use of the present tense. When discussing the works of Jane Austen or Shakespeare, it is normal and natural to speak in the present. The books exist. They are there in front of the student. The drama is genuinely unfolding. But no one in the 1970s would have given a lecture about the times in which those authors lived as if they were alive. Everybody understood the divide. In the 21st century, the staid old historians couldn't resist copying the immediacy of their literature colleagues. It just sounded more modern. The second but simultaneous influence promoting Now Speak came from television. Just as academic history was beginning to lose its innate sense of superiority, a new form of television documentary was born. There'd been little innovation since the days of A.J.P. Taylor in the 1950s and 60s, though many distinguished historians had advised behind the scenes, written scripts, and even occasionally voiced over film. In the dying days of the 20th century, a deliberate effort was made to put working historians in front of the camera. Personalities such as Simon Sharma and David Starkey were created, along with a style of direction that put them firmly in shot, often while highly embarrassing reenactments of historical events took place behind them. The style of commentary that best fitted those images owed more to grandstand than to the brain's trust. Academics who had not been invited to appear were quick to mock. It's not for nothing that the collective noun is a malice of historians. But nevertheless, the style seeped across popular history and thence into academe, constantly refreshing itself as ambitious dons sought exposure in the media, not just for their own advancement, but for the continued health of their departments, now dependent on obvious impact, to secure a funding stream. How could they know that speech patterns appropriate to a particular style of television programme making wouldn't necessarily work on radio as well? Before long, it just seemed to be the way that successful historians talked. Students heard it at university. In a few years, they were in the media, commissioning their old tutors to take part in debates. Producers and academics began to accept that Now Speak was clever. But one of the most annoying things about Now Speak is that it is not yet fully established. As the examples I used earlier show, it's rare to have a programme where all the participants use it in the same way, and any practitioner of Nowspeak may lurch back into normal English at any time. I know of programme makers who've tried to impose some order on the chaos, but also of at least one historian who found it absolutely impossible to talk about the 17th century in the past tense, despite being asked to do several retakes. So we're left with a very unsatisfactory situation. The Now speakers have not yet won, but they're winning. Some fashions die away, but others unaccountably stick. The upward inflection appears to be here to stay. So maybe we need to take action to consign Nowspeak to the place where the prawn cocktail, Viva Zapata moustaches and tank tops have gone. My view is that the best weapon against any fashion is ridicule. There are some recent examples of it working. Few businessmen now talk of pushing the envelope, issues around, or going forward. And there are signs that, with a bit more derision, we may get rid of the meaningless so at the beginning of answers. It's a long time since people spoke of ongoing situations at this moment in time. But Nowspeak is more complex than those catchphrases, and we must be concerted in our attack. We need a comedy character who speaks only in the present tense, perhaps a strip cartoon in Private Eye. If you know or work with academics, ask them to stop. Some of them probably don't even realise they're doing it. We need Nowspeak to become the academic equivalent of picking your nose in public. I can only apologise if you were unaware of Nowspeak. I can guarantee that it will drive you mad now that you know about it. Please join the fight against it, and if you are invited onto a panel of sinners, stick to your guns and use the past tense, even if they try to bully you into entering their land of verbal impoverishment, where they deliberately restrict themselves to a diminished palette of linguistic colours. With luck, people will one day look back on Nowspeak as a temporary, silly affectation, as much a sign of its time as the convoluted, Latinate constructions of 19th century historians. So take courage. Together we can reclaim the past.
That was Eleanor Updale, recorded by Kona McPhee. You can find out more about Eleanor on her website at www.eleanorupdale.com. Next, here's Jonathan Tulloch, with a celebration of linguistic diversity.
The first poem I ever heard was in 1974. It was raining, and Carlisle United were playing Tottenham Hotspurs during their only season in the top flight. I was just tall enough to suck the top of the ground perimeter wall, and young enough to think that the smell of cigarette smoke, close, wet woolen bodies and scotch pies was as good as it gets. The rest of the crowd rise above me like a reed bed. Excitement shivers through them like a wind. Oh, and disappointment. Among them somewhere is the poet. A goal by the opposition flushes him out. A dubious goal. A travesty. A gross injustice. The poet roars in outrage as the referee's whistle validates the score. The blind gad, she's never given that. You're a man, referee, you dog's ass, win it, done it. I bet you me bloody ass, that was nae goal. Sophocles, describing the hapless blinding of Oedipus, couldn't have been more operatically abject. The referee, like the gods, though, remained unmoved. Like all poets, the shouter was dysfunctional. Moments later, his bottle was flying through the air. As though descending from the heavens, it plunged to earth like a brittle angel. Knocking the treasured cup of OXO from my hand, the poet's bottle hit the terrace at my feet and smashed into a million billion pieces. I was 6 years old. My dad never told my mum about it. Have a nice time at the match, Johnny? She asked. Aye, I replied. The word is yes, she shot back. My mother didn't like poets to come from the terraces. As for me, I was smitten. The spoken word, even in its passionate, violent, bottle-throwing mode, was the poetry I fell in love with. Being a native Cumbrian, I'd soon come in contact with Wordsworth, but let's be honest, what are daffodils beside the simple, searing stanzas of the way people spoke? If ever I wrote my own poetic biography in 12 volumes like Wordsworth's Prelude, don't worry, I won't, it would have to be full of Cumbrian dialect. To some extent, I'm still bilingual. Left to myself, I'd still speak and write that way. Along with memories of the anonymous terrace poet and his bottle, cadences of the abandoned language repeatedly echo in my mind. Just to list the vocabulary works the charm of a priest's litany. A man was a gadgee, every man a gadgee. If he was angry, then he was a rudgy gadgee. Before you became a gadgee, when you were still Lal, or Lyle, you were a charver. A charver was also a lad. Girls were always lasses, and sometimes motts. When a lass started going in with you, she became your mot. Your own brother was your boyo. If he happened to be crafty, then he was queer and fly. Queer meant very. Queer and smart. Queer and smart was the highest accolade. If your boyo was the thief, then he'd gone chorin'. If he embarrassed you, then he shunned you. Shunned you. Here, eh? It was a queer shun. To run, which you'd have to do if you chored something, was to peg it. If you ran too quickly, then you gnashed. After gnashing too quickly, you were pirate hooter. If, before you ran and before you chored out, you threw a stone, then you'd hide it. After all that running, you might want something to eat. Well, food was scran. Digs that, look at that. Digs that donut scoffing his scran, eh? 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 If a centre forward missed an easy chance, like ours always did, then he maffed it. Eh? 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 It's untranslatable. Without parallel in other dialects of English, without equivalent in other languages, eh was a constant sentence suffix. We sucked it like sweets. When me mara, knocked at the door, he'd crack on, play with you, eh? Our use of eh was Shakespearean. Eh? Eh?
Eh?
Eh? I know now that each time we spoke, we were dipping into a word hoard of great riches. Our mouths were filled with the word gold of the Vikings. We shouted ourselves hoarse with Norse, eh? Routine occupations of boyhood were planned like Icelandic sagas. Here, aye, first we'll go and yam, we'll get the scran, then now put up our the fells, eh? All of those words, pure Viking talk. There'd been Norwegians round our neck of the woods, having arrived from Ireland and the Isle of Man. They brought with them their words, and this boyhood mastering of Viking was to come in useful many years later when I was on a very long boat, a container ship. The captain was a Norwegian from a lonely fjord. We were discussing language. I don't know why. Gan hjam, he said, seagull eyes swooping at me over his beaker of cognac. You just say, as ganin hjam. That is how they say it in my fjord, too.
Aye, that's how they say it in my firth, I replied. The Solway firth.
Our mouths didn't just handle the word ho of Vikings. The Romany gypsies gave us sounds from the Sanskrit. Sanskrit.
Deeks him.
Deeks. Sanskrit deco for look. Gadji for the Romany gorger. Chore, gypsy for steel. From far away and further back, our words were both archaeological finds and swallows, travelling from impossibly afar, just to nest in our mouths. Our tongues, too, were almost as old as the hills. One word we used was a fossil without price. This was my best friend, this word. Did you have a nice day, Johnny? My mother asked that evening after we'd biked to the fells and back. Hi, I told her. It was a nice yin, queer nice yin. The word yun rolled onto the kitchen table. But rather than recognising its value, my mother shivered at the sight of it. "If you carry on speaking like that," she said, "then you'll end up as a railway navvy, just like Bob Thompson." "Is that what you want?" "I don't mind that, I didn't say. But it seemed quite a good idea to me. Bob Thompson was one of the greatest poets. He lived next door and was a queer smart laugher. He gave me my first drink of beer during the Queen's Silver Jubilee. Unlike my mother, he knew the value of a word as old as Sophocles. Yan, tan, tethera, sethera, pim, pit, yanadik, tanadik. Have you heard that before? That's the old shepherds counting their sheep in on the fells. We weren't shepherds, but for us, Yan was always one. Giz Yan, smart Yan, he's a queer and fly Yan, nice Yan. See, the thing is, me mama didn't ken that I was cracking on in Cumbric. Cumbric? It's a Welsh-related ancient Celtic language spoken around here before the Romans arrived. Echoes of Cumbric can still be heard in the hills themselves. Penny Ghent Fell, Penton Moss. You might hear it in towns like Caer Lwl, Carlisle, the shrine town of the god Lwl or Lug. You'll hear it in Penrith, and I heard it in Bob Thompson when he bought 20 regal king size from Jock, the ice cream van man. "Here, hey, Jock Mara! Did he honour them blue packs, sir? I just he honour them this day." Oh, to pierce the centuries, the millennia, in yon word, ma'am. Didn't you ken that? "Don't call me ma'am," I can hear her saying. "I'm your mum or mother." People who call their mothers ma'am end up on the marshalling yard, working as railway navvies. Bob Thompson wasn't our only neighbour. We lived within earshot of what had been planned as the largest marshalling yard in Europe. "When good Americans die," Oscar Wilde said, "they go to Paris. The bad ones, they go to America. For ma'am, bad Carlisians went to the marshalling yards where they all spoke like poets." Oh, no dissuading her. She, the daughter of factory workers, had her baths, visited castles, walked along paths, and wrung the neck of two long vowels. Little point me saying that my mate, poor Maurice Moore, poor Maurice Moore, was a double trap thong, a gift to language, that, Well, me point, In these language wars, me mam had the ace card. She sent me to the posh school. The posh school, which was also Catholic, and that in a city which still held regular Orange Order parades, but that's another story, was not held in universal esteem by my contemporaries. You also had to wear a pink blazer, and calling it lilac didn't really make it any easier. Carlisle's history is bloody for a reason. The people do not like you if you wear pink blazers. At school, the old language, like a pimply erse, was not tolerated. Outside of school, now that I was a target, the old language became less a celebration and more a survival tactic. In simple terms, a way to avoid being dushed or scudded or brayed or pagged. "Here, Chava, Jules come to the posh school." "Eh? Me? Who are you talking to? Posh school? No, you don't." Enough said, usually. The language trap pursued me into the workplace. My second job was the night shift in a yoghurt factory. A workmate gave me the lowdown. "Nobody bothers with you here, eh? It's cushy bar. If you're clamming for a fag, just go outside. Oh, scran what you want now, eh? See me, yeah, with the yoghurt. I just drink it. There's no inflatable to spot." After a week's work in which I prided myself on being able to differentiate strawberry from raspberry yoghurt blindfolded,
And also, patching up my linguistic parasol, he said to me, "So, when did you move up from London then, Jonathan?" It was then I realised the bitterness. I was no longer a speaker, but a student of a dead language. Et in Arcadia ego, which I bet has never been spoken in Cumbrian before. It was inevitable that when I wrote my first novel, it would be in Carlisle dialect. Et in Arcadia ego, never saw the light of day. But my second novel, which fortunately got published, was wonderfully, blessedly, packed to the rafters with dialect. Geordie. Because by then, like so many other Cumbrians, I'd moved to Newcastle. Oh, a wonderful new language to learn. Similar in some ways, but massively different in others. And even more musical, shall I say. Now I remain. It's like a whole new way of speaking. Like all other dialects, a seaway of history. The author, some unknown hack on the Telegraph wrote, has not written a novel. He is rather concerned with phonetically ascribing the dialect of his characters. Well, that's the only way of describing the magic of dialect, the alchemy that turns a place into people, and vice versa.
That was Jonathan Tulloch, recorded by Francis Burns. You can find out more about Jonathan on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 36, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 37, the non-fiction writer and novelist Max Adams speaks with Kona McPhee about writing and walking, geography and the joys of generalism. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.